Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. I'm Maurice Ardouin, co-host for the podcast Queer Voices of the South, which is found under LGBTQ Studies on the New Books Network. Today, I'm talking to Dr. Andrew Kunkka about his new book, The Life and Comics of Howard Cruz, Taking Risks in the Service of Truth, which was released in December by Rutgers University Press. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Kunkka.
Thanks for having me, Morris.
It's great to have you. We are flattered that you said yes. There's so much to talk about, but I want to give the listeners a little bit about you first, a little bit of context. I have a little blurb that I pulled from the book. It says, Andrew Kunkka is a professor of English and division chair at the University of South Carolina Sumter. He is the author of the book Autobiographical Comics and has also published articles and book chapters on Will Eisner, Kyle Baker, Doug Minch, Jack Katz, and Dell Comics. The book itself, the book blurb, is a great primer for us to do an interview because it talks about exactly what I wanted to talk about. When I'm reading the book, I'm thinking, these are perfect categories for a conversation. In the short format that we have for a podcast episode, we won't be able to get it all in, but I do want to cover as much ground as possible. So I'm going to give the listeners first a little bit about the book from the jacket. It says, The Life and Comics of Howard Cruz, Taking Risks in the Service of Truth, tells the remarkable story of how a self-described preacher's kid from Birmingham, Alabama, became the so-called godfather of gay comics. This study showcases a remarkable 50-year career that included working in the 1970s underground comic scene, becoming founding editor of the groundbreaking anthology series Gay Comics, and publishing the graphic novel Stuck Rubber Baby, partially based on his own experience of coming of age in the civil rights era. Through his exploration of Cruz's life and work, Andrew J. Kunkka also chronicles the dramatic ways that gay culture changed over the course of Cruz's lifetime, from Cold War era homophobia to the gay liberation movement to the AIDS crisis and to the legalization of gay marriage. Highlighting Cruz's skills as a trenchant satirist and social commentator, Kunkka explores how he cast a queer look at American politics, mainstream comics, culture, and the gay community's own norms. That's exactly what we're going to talk about today, all those things. And I tell you, I have to disclose, I am a person who, from that generation, I was coming of age in the 1970s. So, and I remember these comics, so I was thrilled to get this book. And as I was reading it, I was even more thrilled that it put all this in context, and it was reminders that this wasn't just passive comics. These were thought through. Mr. Cruz was very first of all talented, but also determined to do to make some changes, to move the dial. This was not casual. The book is terrifically illustrated. You use a lot of the actual comics that appeared, bits and pieces, and the full comic pages of his various parts of his work, which is delightful. I wish we could show those things, but this is an audio podcast, so we won't. But I wanted to talk to you first of all, congratulations. This is a terrific book. There's so much work in here, and it comes off beautifully. It's a great read. It's as an enjoyable, you don't have to have anything vested in the topic. It's actually fun to read. The thing that struck me at first about you, and I mentioned your background a little bit, is that you are in such an interesting niche in academia. There aren't many people like you doing what you do, examining comics and their creators and the impact on culture. You've been doing that for quite a while. How did you start doing that? How did you come to do that?
Thanks for that introduction and for that question. So I've been a lifelong comic book reader. The family lore is that I learned to read when I was three, and it was comic books mainly, like Archie and Richie Rich and Casper the Friendly Ghost and stuff like that. And so, so I've always I never stopped reading comics, and I'm in my 50s now. And so it was, it was always something I had that's been a kind of dominating hobby in my life. But when I went to graduate school went to undergrad and then graduate school in the 90s, there wasn't, if you got an English major, there weren't a lot of opportunities to do comics, or to study comics. I remember I had an undergraduate professor write a letter of recommendation for me. This is about 1991. And he wrote in a letter, Andy was the first person I knew who was into Art Spiegelman's Mouse. so that was a rare thing at that time. So I did my dissertation, my PhD work in modern British literature, 20th century British literature. This is a story that a lot of comic scholars have who are in English and are of my generation, that the moment I got tenure based on my research and scholarship in that area in 20th century British literature, I just decided I want to spend the rest of my career studying comics. And fortunately around that time too, the field of comic studies was really growing. And it's since grown to be a pretty big multidisciplinary field. So I'm happy that it exists. I'm happy to be a part of it, and that I've got 50 years of research basically under my belt to continue doing this work.
Well, you make a really solid point of the value of comics in this book. There's huge value, and especially as a member of the LGBT community myself, there are parts that choked me up that I looked at and go, wow, that was groundbreaking. There's a lot of you don't use that word lightly. Groundbreaking, a lot of people do use that word lightly. This man was really groundbreaking. Why did you write this book? What brought you to him?
So I had written this book about a kind of general overview of autobiographical comics and how that genre functions in the medium of comics. And one of the things that struck me while doing that, especially in writing about the underground comics of the late 60s and early 70s, was that there were a lot of these creators who did great work in short stories that nobody can, that you can't get unless you go and find these old, these old back issues of underground comics. And that I thought this was a ripe area for not only for study, but for doing something in which there could be a book like this that could be used in classes that or used as a springboard for further study. But anyway, so I thought it was really, you know, it was really unfortunate that there were a lot of great creators that people don't tend to read because they just don't have access to their work. Now with Howard, he did, you know, Stuck Rubber Baby, which is, you know, is a pretty canonical graphic novel, though at the time I started working on this book, it was out of print. Coincidentally, a new edition of it, a 25th anniversary edition, came out from First Second Books while I was working on this project and pretty close to the end of it. So that is now available. But for the most part, his shorter works were hard to find. And a lot of these works are really, you're really innovative in terms of how he uses the comics medium in unique and innovative ways to tell stories. And so I wanted to do something that kind of celebrated and explored those things, so that those stories, so that they could, you know, again, someone could hopefully pick this up and build on the work that went into it. And so it happened to be too that the editor of the series at Rutgers University Press, Frederick Luis Aldama, was putting together this series called Critical Graphics, which was going to do exactly what I was hoping I could do with some of these creators that I was finding in the autobiographical comics book that I thought needed, could use this kind of exposure. And so when he announced the series, and actually I've worked with him before, so he asked me if I had anything I wanted to do for it. I said, yeah, absolutely. You know, I want to do a book about Howard Cruz.
You take us through these big shifts in history of LGBT through this man's work, and contextualize it, because you could look at the illustrations, the novel graphic panels, just the word choice. There's so many components in his work that are not they're not subtle. He was very, very blunt. A lot of the illustrations would not be welcome in mainstream anywhere. And I remember them again as a person back then who was going, and you'd see this kind of thing and go, wow, this is so cool. You don't get to see that anyplace. And it was kind of, it was liberating. It was one of those things, this isn't so spooky or scary, because to be in that world at that time, in this time too, but in that back in the 70s, to be a person who is just figuring his own or her own way out of about how to be in this kind of world, there wasn't a lot to go on. And these comics, this kind of writing, was just so welcome, so illuminating. So you know, it was a huge. Not endorsement. What's the word I want? Affirmation that we were real, we're queer, we're here, get used to us kind of thing. What I loved about it is that it was, you know, some parts of these panels you would think on the surface are like, oh, that's kind of raunchy. But then at the point it's making is like so damn profound. It's like, oh, absolutely. That's the way to tell it. So you didn't shy away from any of that, because he didn't shy away from any of that. I on this podcast, I have so far done a lot of books that are putting the history of LGBT world into context, especially in the United States. This piece was so critical. This man's work, I mean, this piece of the history was so critical, because that was a time when there was so much movement, and that's mentioned in your blurb of the book about the Cold War era homophobia, the gay liberation movement that started after Stonewall, actually started before Stonewall, but Stonewall helped solidify that. Then the AIDS crisis, which threw everything into just a spiral of weirdness. And then legalization of gay marriage, which I actually never thought would happen in my own lifetime. When that happened, I was kind of in disbelief. I didn't trust it. A lot of us, we did not have emotional vocabulary for being married. We did not know what that was about. all these things are shifting, not only for us, but the outside world. I'm like, whoa, see us as we really are, and, you know, demystify a lot of us. So he was great at doing that very thing, demystifying it. Let's see. I wanted to talk to you about, and stop myself from talking, talk to you about, you started out with the autobiographical work, that this is autobiographical. He used a lot of his own life, but of course he took characters, he made characters that you could tell as a reader were based on him, but also that they were fictionalized. And he mentioned somewhere, and I forget where, but that he says, I couldn't possibly put my mundane life down. I'm bent over a drawing desk most of my day, and so my life is actually not that exciting. But he made the characters based on his life very quite exciting. I wanted you to talk about that autobiographical fiction versus fictional autobiography, which is one of your chapters. That was fascinating to me. Tell us about that whole concept.
Okay. When I wrote the autobiographical comics book, one of the things I became really interested in finding out, looking at this idea about what does truth mean in terms of autobiography, especially in terms of doing autobiography in comics form. Because if we read a prose autobiography, we could look at the back cover and see, a photograph of the person, or they'll usually be photographs within the book of, the person throughout their lives. So while we're reading that, we have a picture of what that person, looks like through time. And, there's ways that, we read autobiography in a way in which, as one of the things I talk about, this idea of the autobiographical contract, that there's this kind of trust that the reader has that in the veracity of what they're reading. And so one of the questions I had was what happens to this when you're reading an autobiographical story that's mediated through an artist's hand, so that artist is drawing, an avatar representation of themselves that isn't exactly them, but is their kind of image of them. What choices does that creator make then in terms of truth telling? Is there, since the visual representation of comics from the avatar of the character through, any other details in the story are, choices that creator has made and are filtered, then what does truth mean in that? And do we privilege certain kinds of truth, like, the factual truth versus an emotional truth? And, but what Howard did was go even a step further, which is to, in a lot of these stories, is to, in some cases, like the one called The Guide, which is about an early acid trip, to take us on what feels like an autobiographical story, and then twist it at some point where you get this, this absurd and kind of horrifying conclusion to that story. I don't want to give it all away because it's a fun twist that is absolutely can't possibly be autobiographical. So to kind of lure us in with this idea that we're kind of comfortable in this world of, of truth telling that we're imagining is our relationship as readers to the creator, and then to throw this curveball in. That's a pretty fun way to approach autobiography. But then there's the other things that he did to kind of just mine his own experience, but then create fictional stories around it. And I think the best example of that, one of his most groundbreaking stories, is the story Jerry Mack, where he, which is about a conservative evangelical preacher who's remembering back to a relationship he had with a young man that became romantic and ended up causing him to be driven out of this this conservative small southern town. And one of the thing, you know, when I was doing research on this book, I went to Howard's papers, which are in Columbia University's library. His whole archive is there. And I found letters that talked about the event on which that story is based. Now he took an experience that he kind of witnessed, that he and his family witnessed, and created a character who is a young cartoonist in it, even though that wasn't specifically Howard's experience and relationship with the real person who Jerry Mack is based on, but then created this amazing story. And to tell that story from the point of view of the preacher and the you know tensions that he's experiencing and the unresolved conflict that he still has, you know, as now a married man with children, is just a really amazing exercise, I think, in empathy for that character. Whereas I think a more traditional approach would have been to tell the story, you know, as the kind of young observer that he was of the experience and not being actually involved in it. And so to take the route he did, I think really makes for a much more amazing story.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, all of these pieces that you share with us in the book, and I wanted to ask you about that too, about getting access to those. And I know in the very beginning, I think you say that you worked with Mr. Cruz himself to get this. That was a stroke of luck that he was around and he helped you. And I forgot where I was going with that, but let's talk about that. How was it working with him? You got to work with this man. And he was one of those people that everyone assumed, oh, he's long gone, but he was still around.
Yeah, that was one of the hardest things I've ever had to deal with, because when I decided to write about Howard, he was still with us. And, you know, I contacted him, asked for permission to do the book, to use his papers and so on. And he was really helpful. He was happy to be involved in it. He was really, he was really eager for it. And so the original plan I had for the book was actually to be working with him much more closely. And in fact, I had a big chunk of the book was going to be a kind of career spanning interview with him. And so we had exchanged a lot of emails, and he shared some emails with some anecdotes in them that were helpful. And, that went into my proposal for the book with Rutgers. And then when Rutgers accepted, that proposal, then I started contacting Howard again to kind of ramp up what we were doing. And at that point, he wrote to me and said that he was being treated for cancer, and that chemotherapy treatments would probably kind of wipe him out quite a bit. And so could we put off doing the big interview until he felt better? And I said, you know, I said, sure. And, you know, wished him the best of luck with his treatment. And then around, I think it was November of 2019 or so, he contacted me and said that things weren't going well. And that if we wanted to do the interview, we better do it soon. And then unfortunately 2 days later he passed away. So, yeah. And, so I didn't get to do that interview, but I did get his input on a lot of stuff and was able to ask him some questions. His husband, Ed Cederbaum, was great afterwards and support and read through the manuscript and gave me some pointers and added some things. And his agent and good friend and publisher, Dennis Kitchen, was a great asset as well. But you know, it would have been a much different book if, I'd gotten to work more closely with Howard in the later parts of it. But I'm grateful that I got to know him at all, you know, and got to share emails with him and have these conversations with him. And he really saw this project as being a big part of what, of his legacy, that the, you know, if a book like this gets used in classrooms and gets, used as a supplement to Stuck Rubber Baby or on its own, that, his work will be remembered in this way. And that was, I felt a huge amount of responsibility towards that.
Well, you do it justice, let me tell you, because it was so enlightening for me. Again, somebody who actually went through it and saw these things in real time, I'm like, whoa, it's so easy to forget that a lot of people, especially younger generations, have no clue about what had to happen in all points of the world going on for LGBTQ people. Nothing was taken for granted. There was so much hard work done just to move the needle bit by bit. That's why I told you earlier it was such a surprise when marriage equality came out. I was like, I didn't trust that. Wait a minute, that seemed to have happened too fast, even though it was decades and decades in the making. So he to use that word again, groundbreaking. He broke so much ground, and thank you, as a member of the LGBT community, for putting this together. And I do feel that, you know, it's so sad that he passed away, but you did do what you everything you could, what you got, because it's amazing to go through this, and there's so many wow moments that. I had told you some moments choked me up. Some moments made me say bravo. Some made me want to scream. You know, there's so much emotion in all these story, in his storytelling and the way you tell his story. So thank you for that. We have some time left. I want to ask you a couple things about his commentary. He was a social commentator, in a time where not a lot of people were listening. Except this, you know, our own little groups. And he was very, what I loved about his work was that he was satirical. He was always tongue in cheek. He had a lot of fun with this. This was not all hard work. It was a lot of fun. You can tell that there was joy in his work. He was a joyful writer.
Yeah. That's something I really try to get it. I really try to get across is that, that joy, you know, his earliest work in comics was a strip he did that got published by Dennis Kitchen's Kitchen Sinks Press and a bunch of different places called Barefoots. And Barefoots got a lot of criticism from other underground cartoonists like Art Spiegelman, because it was too cute, And I think on, you know, on the surface, it does look like, a cute comic strip, but when you read it, that cuteness is a veneer over some, pretty trippy stuff about, about sex and drugs and all that in that late '60s, early '70s era. And it definitely is fitting with the underground sensibility, even though a lot of the underground cartoonists didn't see it that way. Dennis Kitchen thankfully did, but he did. Howard also did Barefoots before he came out as a cartoonist, came out kind of publicly, basically around the time just before he starts editing gay comics, and then seems to really, really cut loose after that point with, you described some of the kind of graphic choices that he makes, but his stuff is hilarious. Some of the stuff's very serious. I mean, Jerry Mack is a very serious story, and some of the other stuff he's known for is serious. But when he cuts loose in his satire, it's hilarious. And one of my favorite pieces he did, and this was one of the things he and I discussed and kind of bonded over, is the his parody of Little Lulu, The Nightmares of Little Lulu. As a kid, he had a subscription to Little Lulu Comics, and it was his favorite comic. And it really shows through. I mean, this is it's a very biting satire in which, but it's a satire that definitely shows someone who knows Lulu's story and characteristics inside and out. And so he loved those comics growing up, and I'm a big fan of Little Lulu and of Dell Comics in general, and I write about those in other places, and so that that's one of the areas where we connected. In fact, back in the 50s, Dell Comics had this little paragraph. Usually at the end of the comic, that was called the Dell Pledge to Parents, that said, basically that this is good, wholesome entertainment for children. But he had memorized that pledge to parents and could still recite it, 50 plus years, or, 60 years or so after he had been, reading those comics. I think Little Lulu, The Nightmares of Little Lulu, is probably the best and my favorite example of his ability to do satire, but also his ability to mimic other artists. He had just an incredible eye for doing these uncanny versions of other people's characters. One of the other stories that I included in the book was the story Raising Nancy's, in which he does a great imitation of Ernie Bushmiller's Nancy for a very dark, dark story.
Yeah. Yeah. And I noticed that. I wanted to go back to the complaints of Art Spiegelman and all. One of the things, again, as a reader in real time, I remember that it was accessible. The cutesiness, it did draw you in. And then you write, absolutely right. Again, the readers can't see, listeners can't see this now, but they need to get the book to see this. These comics go way deeper than that cutesy. And some of these you think, wow, he got away with that? I like satire in general, but you're right. When you're flipping through this book and you see that strip, that the Nancy's and the Little Lulu, you think, oh, wow, is that legal? That he could get so close, and you could hardly put them side by side and not tell the difference. So he had many, many talents. And what I liked about him, and this is Queer Voices of the South, is his Southernness really comes through. God bless your hellbound little heart, you know, that kind of mentality. I love that. And it comes across in his work. So that's one of the things that, again, because I'm a Southerner, it also maybe I have a prejudice for that accessibility. He was speaking language that was natural to me. But I'm not unique in that. I think he was speaking language that was natural to people all over the place. So he did reach, I think, new people with the work, and you make that real plain. And the book takes this and puts it in its rightful place in the history, because I think what happens with a lot of things, there's a lot that easy to forget. It's just more convenient when we're talking about our history, LGBTQ history, is that there's so much to look ahead about, not in an optimistic way either, to watch out what's happening now. You can't rest on what all the work that's been done, but you're going to be condemned or you're going to suffer if you don't acknowledge and appreciate what was done before, because those foundations were not random. So he was one of those foundation builders. I wanted to ask you, you kind of started talking about it when you talked about Little Lulu and the Nancy's, your favorite of all of his pieces. Did you have one that stuck out in whatever area?
I think Jerry Mack is probably my favorite, not just because I think it's a great story and a really well made comic. It's a comic that you can talk about, not just the content, which is very moving and effective, but the formal qualities of it are really, innovative and interesting on their own. The choices of the number of panels that he jams into the story and the way he constructs a page and so on. But also the fact that, that I came across in the research this, trove of correspondences about that story that really opened up the autobiographical nature of it. So I love that story for all those reasons. But I also think that that is one of his other major short stories is Billy Goes Out, which I've got in the commentary and satire section. Because again, that is also a really formally innovative comic, but that's a comic that really also gets at what Howard's ethos was behind gay comics, because it's basically the story of this young man in early 1980s, just before the AIDS crisis hits, and what his basically social life is like, going out to bars, having these, these quick trysts and so on out there. And then, but then also the top half of every panel is what's going on in his mind, his internal life. And there's such a depth to that internal life that, stands in an interesting contrast to the life he's leading in this one night as he goes out. When I first read that when I was a kid, it that was incredibly moving and eye-opening to me as well.
So many parts of his work did all kinds of things all at once. He never did anything simple. He may have had some one-offs that we don't see in this, and they're not important to this particular piece of his history. But maybe it's you, maybe it's in your book, and I don't remember. I've read a few different recently, but he changed the formatting. I mean, he did his own typography hand lettering. He broke technical grounds, not just storytelling grounds. He was indulged that because he was getting such a positive following. He was there were you know success breeds success. So in a technical way, he was a groundbreaker as well. And I find that, you know, fascinating. He seems to have been kind of a Renaissance man. You know, he had so many things he could have done with his life. And thank God he did this with his life. But he would have been, it seems, successful in so many places. He was that kind of a person. And you bring that out. Well, you know, these stories are just, they seem to go, there's so much beneath this surface of this. I think we're coming to the end. We try to keep around 40, 45 minutes. Sometimes we go longer, but our audiences are getting more restless with us as time goes on. So I wanted to let you give our listeners any kind of more information they might need. Is there going to be an audiobook, for example, which is kind of hard in with a very visually dependent piece like this, but maybe an audiobook would include a main reader and then reader of the comics. So that might come across. Is that possible?
I didn't really consider that since I work, you know, with such a visual medium, but there is definitely a possibility of that, I guess. I've never broached it with Rutgers and they haven't brought it up, but
well, biographically,
that could be really interesting.
I think it would have merit because biographically speaking, you could tell this man's story and in so many ways, you could have multiple character readers for an audio presentation. And that's what make those particularly listenable is giving them more of a theatrical kind of thing. And this is so theatrical. And yet, you know, you're an academic. It's so rich with context. So there's so much value here. I would hope that you can exploit it. Maybe we'll see a movie by this, you know.
That's interesting that you say that because I think there is some interest in somebody doing possibly doing something else with Howard's life, whether it's using this book or using his own you know, his other works like Stuck Rubber Baby or something like that as the basis for it.
Yeah, I could see that. If you have anything to tell these readers to convince them to go out and get that book, here's your time.
one of the things I really appreciate about what you said about the book is something that I've strived to do because I work in an academic background and it's very easy, you know, as an academic writer to slip into, a really kind of dense and complex, writing style, writing for that audience. And one of the things I was really striving to do with this book is to make it accessible to a wider range of readers. So it's not, you know, it's not just there for an academic audience. It's there for anybody who might be interested in any of the things we've talked about, whether it's comics or the history of LGBTQ community in America, or all these other things. And so I appreciate when people say things like what you've said about the book, because that's definitely what I was aiming for. Plus, it was a really emotional project to work on. And I hope that the emotion is conveyed through the language that I used.
Well, you succeed in all that. I can tell you as a reader of many different types of genres, this book pulls you in. Again, I don't think you have to be an LGBT person. You can have so many different interests. One of them being just like you have is I love comics. You're a historian or are you just like the LGBT angles? There's so much here that makes this a really terrific read as a reader, and I appreciate that because I like to move through a book, and I get eager when I get my hands on a good book. I can't wait to finish it so I can go back and start cross examining. I go back to pages, I make notes, and I tear books apart. Right, you know, it's not just one go for me, but that makes it fun. If I have a book that I just get through and, you know, I'm glad that's over, those are disappointing. This is one of those that goes, oh, I could see this becoming. And that's when you mentioned in your prologue or preface that he passed away, Mr. Cruz passed away. And so we didn't get to have that wonderful interview because you can tell there's going to be so much more. There could be so much more of this story, although you feel a really solid book without that piece of it. It just whets the appetite to know this man more. So I think that would be a terrific idea if there is such a biopic of this man's life coming out one of these days, and you helped spur that. So congratulations again. The world needs this story. I want the readers to read this story. I wish you all the best in making that happen. I have just to tell the audience that the book, the title again, is The Life and Comics of Howard Cruz, that's C-R-U-S-E, Taking Risks in the Service of Truth by Dr. Andrew J. Kunkka from Rutgers University Press, and it's freshly out in December 2021, so it's there. Go get it. You won't be disappointed. Thank you, everybody. Join us again for the next episode of Queer Voices of the South. Goodbye.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, great. And it was, like I said, we were flattered that she said yes. I know people like you are so busy. Thank you so much.
Thanks.